So what does he normally... Oh, come in, please. Yes, sit down. Sorry.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
More cheese? Yes, that look of bitter disappointment that flits across the face of the guest when they realise that the crystal is not real. How sad. It is drawing room time. Now, history tonight. Well, and other things. I think we may not just restrict ourselves to that. But it's something that history, more often than not, written by men, of men. Australian history is no different, nor, some might argue, is the Australian present. We might come to that. Dr. Claire Wright is a historian. Or should that be an historian?
You can say anything you want, Jonathan.
Well, I will.
I'm just thinking how fetching you look in that tuxedo.
Thank you. I thought I'd frock up. Dr. Claire Wright is an historian. So maybe she's the exception that breaks our history rule and crashes through history's glass ceiling. It's not a grass ceiling. What am I saying?
Not these days. Maybe the 1970s, the universities, there might have been the grass ceiling.
But... okay, yes, but less said about that. The better, her new book focuses on... well, people involved in one of Australia's defining and transformative moments, the Eureka Stockade. It's called The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, and I think you can join the dots as to who exactly may have been forgotten and why. And she joins you in the drawing room along with writer and broadcaster George McEncroe. George has been a teacher, ethicist, war crimes investigator and nurse's attendant before becoming a writer, broadcaster and comedian. So she's nothing if not a creature of logical career progression. Now, she's been hosting... I've got to laugh. She's been hosting a series of talks at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne about birth, death and marriage, events that often as not have a rather feminine skew. Ladies, welcome.
Great to be here.
Claire, Eureka Stockade. It's one of those things, one of those moments in our past that we think we've got pretty well summed up.
Yep, we all have a crack at it at school.
We do.
One time or another.
Grade six, I think, usually.
Yeah, and then generally they do it again in high
Australian
school.
Australian history. Yeah.
And certainly with the national curriculum coming in, it'll be a mainstay
because
for our students for a long time.
I read a piece you wrote in one of the websites locally about how, as an event, it has something for everybody. It's all things to all people.
That's right. I mean, it's a story that is at the centre of our mythology about what it means to be Australian, where we came from, how the things that we hold today as being the values we like to ascribe to ourselves as Australian. We could argue about whether that's true or not, but, you know, freedom, justice, egalitarianism, standing up for your rights, standing up for your mates, and all of these things are brought back to Eureka in one way or another. It's seen as the birthplace of Australian democracy and where the men stood truly by each other and fought to defend their rights and liberties. And this tradition extended through the 19th century and it had then morphed into the diggers of the First World War and became sort of dovetailed neatly with the Gallipoli legend as that was then spun out.
It's seamless, isn't it?
It is seamless, but there are faults in the glass.
Well, the men you point out there.
That's
choosing
right.
Your words, I'm imagining, with care.
I'm choosing them with care because I'm giving you the narrative that has been drawn for the last 150 years or so, right up until last year, the last mainstream book about Eureka was published. But the part of the story that has always been left out was the pivotal role that women played in these events. And because that has been left out of the story, because these characters, these women, the fact that women were even there as a presence at all on the goldfields, because this has been forgotten, it means that all of those values that we associate with Eureka, I think, have also been kind of gendered male. Mm. So we see those as being particularly masculine virtues and therefore the Australian national character becomes essentially a masculine one as well. And I think that's unfair and it's also bollocks.
She said, not putting too fine a point on it. Nice tag.
Well, yeah, I didn't realise, Claire, just reading the book, and I haven't finished, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, but the ways in which women at the event of the stockade were killed and injured that I had always envisaged that it was men behind the barricades and men who were shot and killed by the troops. So why did that get...
Well, you'd have no reason to believe anything other than that, because that's what we've always been taught. That's the way that the story has always been told.
But why would the people on the ground then leave that out? Why would that be an omission?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. Firstly, everybody wanted to forget about the Eureka Stockade event itself immediately after it happened. Both sides, from the government side, who had actually done the killing, the majority of the killing, it was a massacre. They called it a massacre at the time, the Eureka Massacre.
The 27 people killed?
We now know that it's at least 30 people killed.
Right.
This book is the first time that it's been documented that a woman was killed, but there's now about 30 names that are attached, which is more than Peter Lawler's original list was 22. He mm-hmm. published that in 1855, and that's what's been inscribed on all the monuments and the memorials in Ballarat ever since. But it's clear that there were far more than that, and it's not just the people who were killed, it's actually what happened after the 10 minutes of fighting that's incredibly important, because the stockade, which was just a flimsy structure of some overturned carts and some water barrels and some of the timber slabs that were used in the mine shafts. It was really a defence, like a safe house that was very quickly put up because of the events that I describe, in order to protect the miners who had burnt their licences a couple of days earlier. But what happened after the stockade was overrun by the troops when they attacked at 3 a.m. on Sunday the 3rd of December was that an order was given that the police could then torch all of the tents that were surrounding the stockade. And one of the things we have to understand is that the stockade wasn't a purpose-built fortress for a military event. It was just this flimsy barricade that was thrown up in the middle of the diggings. So encircled by this stockade were tents that contained the women and children who were living as part of this community, and this community was the Eureka community. That's why we call it that. It was the Eureka lead. And so inside that stockade were tents that contained stores, women and children living there. There was a woman who was giving birth while the stockade event was actually happening. And afterwards, the troops said, set fire to it all, burn it to the ground. And all the tents that were surrounding the stockade on the outside, because they were afraid that the rebels would escape into these tents. And it was actually then that all of the damage was done, that women were being fired upon, that their homes were being burnt down, that they lost everything that they owned, and there is suggestion that some even more villainous acts of things that happen when troops go mad.
Troops run amok.
When troops go amok happened.
George, I mean, as a consumer of history and of these stories, does it ever strike you that it's an unfinished and incomplete business? Are you taken by the absence of women from those tales?
Yeah, I am. And I think the more you know, the more sort of irritating it becomes that there's always 50% of the population is left unaccounted for and unspoken about. And that idea of a nation being gendered, and I used to do this when I was teaching myself, and I'd say, so describe an Australian, and immediately boys and girls would refer to, well, he's this. And I think, you know, what about an Australian woman? What are her qualities? And there'd be this kind of gaping silence, you know, really, unless you were the generation who watched the Sullivans, and you might think of somebody, you know, who sits stoically by her husband, but she's a very quiet, unknown, mysterious character onto which any qualities can be put, you know, upon her at any time. And I think what I love about Claire's book is that we follow individual women and their history and their children and their concerns, which were not apolitical. I mean, I think it's interesting when, Jonathan, you said, why were some of these stories omitted? And that women would write to the press, when they did write to the press and be published, they omitted their names because the public's fear was, I mean, it's still a pretty scary place to be a woman. Ask Julia Gillard. but or ask any feminist who gets on Twitter or sticks her head over the parapet for any reason, you've got to have a pretty thick skin even now to speak out. But then these women, they wrote anonymously to the paper.
George McEncrow and Claire Wright in the drawing room, and with women, history, these things we're talking about, Claire.
It's one of the reasons that the book is called The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, because there were a number of women coming from what we now would call different sides of politics or from different backgrounds who were acting in rebellious ways. And, George, that's what you're pointing to. Women who were writing to the newspapers, pointing out the problems that were going on in the goldfields, who were acting as the voice of community. It's been just fantastic for me to re-find these women, to dig them up and to put flesh and bones around them.
That digging is really interesting. I mean, as a historian, how much harder is that? How much of the material is skewed towards a male version? How much harder is it to find the female stories that accompany it?
Well, that's twofold. I mean, this book has taken me 10 years of research, and that's not because it was difficult to find the voices of the women. It's taken me 10 years is because there was so much material to get through. Now, when I started the project, I had a number of male colleagues, senior male historians, who said, "What could you possibly say about Eureka that hasn't already been said?" And basically, after 10 years of doing this, I could still keep going. In fact, I cut 50,000 words out of the book, and it's still 540 pages long. And for me, the thing is that if you go back to the same sources that other people have been to before you, and you're armed with a different set of questions, you'll find different answers. And if I can give you an example of that, there's a diary that's been cited many times before by previous historians. And that diary used to be known as the Lazarus Diary. My research uncovered the fact that it wasn't written by this Samuel Lazarus at all. It's a different fellow called Charles Evans. But there's a passage that he writes on the 4th of December where he notes that there is a funeral procession going by his tent, and he's not a miner, he's not associated with the action at all. There's a funeral procession going by. He notes that one of the coffins that is passing, that has a long train of mourners, hundreds of mourners behind him. He says this coffin was trimmed with white and it contained the body of a woman who was, in his words, mercilessly butchered by the troopers while defending the life of her husband. Now, that's there, plain on the page. It has never been used before in any treatment of Eureka.
But that's culpable, isn't it? I mean, academically.
Well, it depends what you look at. I mean, it's like a bad cop, I suppose, or, you know, tries to build a case. You omit the evidence that doesn't sit with what you're trying to say. So if you're trying to make the facts fit the myth and the legends and what you know will, A, sell, B, be popular, you know, every historian has to sing for their supper, every academic has to publish to keep tenure and to keep grants flowing. So, you know, why, if you're going to start focusing, not that they would think it was a bad thing necessarily, it's just not in line with what they're interested in.
And what it does is it opens a Pandora's box. So if you then account for that detail that this woman was killed, you have to then say, well, what is she doing there? How many more were there? What were they doing? Why did they come? And it unsettles that narrative so much, and you have to keep going with it. And there are so many examples of this. And George, this ties into the work that you're doing. But for example, I went to the Ballarat Times and I was looking at the ads, not just the letters to the editor and the more political stuff, but the ads. And there's an ad for a chemist, a pharmacy tent. And one of the things that this particular fellow was selling, and there's a whole list of the items, and one of these items was breast pumps.
Wow.
So if you come across something like that, you can just say, you know, well, that's irrelevant to the Eureka Stockade, so I won't try to account for that. Or you can say,
but where there's a breast pump, there's...
Where there's a breast pump, there's a breast. Where there's a breast, there's a woman. Where there's a woman who needs a breast pump, there's a lactating woman. Where there's a lactating woman who needs a breast pump to relieve her mastitis, there's possibly a woman who's just lost her baby or her baby is failing to thrive. This is where it comes into your births, deaths and marriages thing. So... And there are clearly enough of these people that this fellow reckons he can turn some coin by selling breast pumps. So, again, it unlocks this series of questions, and it's all of that rich detail of the social context that I think provides the political context for why the Eureka Stockade happened at the beginning, in the first place, because these men were not just diggers, they were husbands, they were fathers, they were watching their babies die in tents, they were watching their wives die in tents in childbirth, and they couldn't do anything about it because they were too poor and they were too powerless.
Mm. But it makes the story a real thing. It gives the story some emotional weight. It's not just about tax and representation and money.
No, it's human beings thriving or dying, failing to thrive in this incredibly tense time. And I think that, you know, looking at why women's stories are omitted, I think the whole notion of women as courageous characters, you know, so this woman dies defending her husband, that sits uncomfortably with the male psyche. And I think one of the things that came up again and again in the lectures at the Wheeler Centre, they weren't like talks, was how many of these women who, you know, push a human being into the world and yet can't discuss the story of their birth anywhere except in this tiny little community hall for a few weeks afterwards, because it's not done so. And, you know, delivering a baby is a woman's version of running over the top. You know, it's the most dangerous time in your life. Up until very recently, it was the leading cause of death for women under 25. And, you know, in many countries it still is.
If you talked about it, people would stop doing it.
Well, maybe that's the fear, but it's also that sort of, we'll just push it behind closed doors. And you know, one of the things that we've talked about, if men had babies, you know, or if men even had periods, would there be competitions for how long, how much blood lost, how many tampons did you have to go through, how many, you know.
But this is the experience of your work, and it's where, in Claire's there's the revelation of history and so much forgotten, but in yours, in contemporary life, in so much of life experience, the female experience is removed from the
but we can join them up.
Broad picture.
They're not separated, and because one of the things that I document in the book is that on the Saturday night, the 2nd of December, there were 1,500 people in the stockade itself. All day there had been 1,500 people. By the time the troops come in at 3 o'clock the next morning, there's only 150 left. Now, the theory as to why they'd all left in the past has been that all the men went off to get drunk. And that's been
Sounds
entirely logical. If you are accepting that all there are on the goldfields are men. But there's no evidence that they actually went off to get drunk. Now, I pose an alternative theory based on somewhat contentious scientific evidence of the theory of lunar menstrual synchronicity, which is that, firstly, women's menstrual cycles regulate to each other when they're together. And there were 5,000 women in Ballarat and 6,000 children. A third of the Ballarat population were women and children.
Very close
at
quarters.
At this time, very close quarters, living in tents under the moon, pre-electricity. And at this time, this is where the lunar part of it comes in, that women's cycles regulated to the moon. Women ovulated on the full moon. Eureka Stockade happened under a full moon. Is it possible that potentially where all of these men went that night was not necessarily to get drunk, but to go and have a shag?
Winning combination of the two.
Why not?
But once you put all of the players back in there, certainly the birth statistics show that that's possible.
Yeah.
There was an absolute baby boom going on in Ballarat at the time. There's no reason why that couldn't be possible. It's a common sense, and in a sense it's a female perspective on an historical event that
really shifts that perceived reality.
That's correct.
Mm. Amazing. And look, it's to be recommended. The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka is Claire Wright's book that we've been discussing. Dr. Claire Wright, historian. And George McEncroe has been with us too. George, writer, broadcaster, comedian, hosting a series of talks at Melbourne's Wheeler Centre on births, deaths and marriages. And the next of those, if you're in the vicinity, is coming up on the 21st of November.
You come along, free event, Wheeler Centre, marriages we're talking.
And if you're in Sydney on the 21st of November, the same date as George, there is an event to launch this book in Sydney at Glee Books at 7 p.m.
Something for everyone. That's it for The Drawing Room and for RN Drive tonight. Stay with us on RN for Big Ideas straight after the 8 o'clock news, the final BBC Wreath Lecture from Grayson Perry. Julian Morrow in with you for RN Drive tomorrow night, Friday. I'm back on Monday.